can warm my heart. Now that I've known the color.
Hi, everybody. This is Knives Monroe.
And I'm Juan Molina.
And this is the Filmwork Podcast. How you, man? How you doing?
Pretty good, you know. Tomorrow, I pick up my stuff for South by Southwest.
That's right. That's coming up. We were just talking about this off mic. I have severe social anxiety, and I'm not looking forward to South by at all. I'm not an Austin native. I've been here for 6 months, but I'm definitely a Texas native, and I'm not looking forward to it one bit.
I can totally feel you.
It sounds completely stressful. And it sounds like it's just the prospect of all those people are making me anxious. My hands are sweating. We're in a comfy room right now recording this podcast, which is, by the way, the first episode of the Filmwork Podcast. And my palms are sweating because I'm thinking about South By, and it's freaking me out.
Yeah, you know, I was actually telling you a few of my horror stories of a few film festivals I've been up to, and they seem to be getting better. So I'm hoping by this time I don't get attacked.
Yeah, you're much more of a vet to South By and to festivals in general than I am.
Yeah. By the end, you just feel like dying a little bit.
Yeah, I feel like dying right now. I'm just thinking about it. I've turned down, you know, concerts and like live wrestling shows because I'm afraid of the parking. I'm afraid of all the cars that are there. Like if it's a Six Flags or something, it's really too anxious for me. And it's weird because I'm a pretty sociable guy.
Yeah, you are.
But just all those people breathing air scares me. I'm just afraid that someone's going to snipe all of us.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
It's weird.
But South by Southwest is kind of Austin's biggest film festival, so I'm hoping to see a few good movies.
I saw Ty West, a director and writer of The Innkeepers, tweeted recently that South by Southwest is the spring break of filmmakers in America.
Yeah.
And I like that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and it's a very fun event. You know, I've never been much of a spring break kind of guy, but I'm a fan of movies, and if I can watch 3 movies a day, I'm good.
Speaking of spring break, do you know if Harmony Korine's going to show Spring Breakers?
Yeah, I believe that's one of the few films I'm actually going to get to interview a few of the stars for.
That's very cool.
I guess so. Cool. You know, going to ask Selena Gomez about Justin Bieber and what happened there.
She's never gotten that question before.
Yeah.
That's a film work exclusive.
I'm going to be totally original. Hey, how was that Bieber dick?
How was that Bieber dick? Oh, my God. The Biebs. Wow. What do the pubes and the Biebs look like is what you're going to ask. That's scary.
That is a scary thought. And then James Franco, I'm going to ask him about his fake teeth and how was it.
Wearing the grill, yeah. Going back to Justin Bieber's pubes, is it just me or
we should just make this whole podcast about pubes?
Oh, we just want to say right now this is episode one and we're hitting the ground running talking about Justin Bieber's pubes. But is it just me or do you look at it like it's just shaved, just pure shaved? He has a zero down there.
You know, I see him as kind of somebody who wants to prove he's manly, so he probably has a little bit.
Are you saying there's a little airstrip down there?
Yeah, he's got it. He's got it.
Treasure trail, as they call it.
Yeah, he's got it covered.
It would be wonderful if Justin Bieber just had straight up bush.
Yeah, I
can't. Just like a profane, I'm sorry, yeah, just fucking insane amount of bush down there would be really awesome.
If his bush looked like Andrew Infante's hair.
Right, Andrew Infante, sorry, that's one of the writers of film work, but if you've seen the top of his head, that's Justin Bieber's bush apparently.
And I'm going to totally ask about that.
And you heard it first here on the Film Work Podcast. Well, Jerry, we should get down to brass tacks.
Yeah.
Because as much as I could fill up 90 minutes about Justin Bieber's bush, I think that we should get into the matter at hand, and that's The Master. Paul Thomas Anderson's The Master, 2012 release, was released on Blu-ray just last week. As a matter of fact, we just saw the Blu-ray tonight and all of the special features.
So we're going to be breaking down this whole Blu-ray.
We're going to be breaking it down.
Spoilers will be coming ahead. We will warn you, but I'm just saying, if you haven't seen The Master, see it right now because it was easily the best film of 2012. Heck, it might easily be the best film of the last 10 years.
It's very possible.
And I'm just saying, you should stop this. Go buy it at Walmart, Amazon, streaming, Netflix, whatever. I don't care. Just go watch it. I'm not condoning anything, but just watch the film because it's that good.
You know what? That's true. Jerry's not going to condone downloading, but if you have to do it by whatever means necessary. Check out The Master. That's what we're going to be talking about here on episode one of the Filmwork Podcast. So I suppose we'll just get into it. What were your expectations heading into The Master?
Expectations. You know, every PTA film, I shouldn't say every because I've only been like a fan of him since he made The Weird Blood. But I've been excited for the Master for a long time, like since pretty much 2008. And I know, like, I know this sounds weird because the film probably wasn't even announced then, but I've just been waiting for his film since I can remember.
Wow. How did you get into Paul Thomas Anderson's filmography?
You know, when I was around 12, maybe 11 years old, I was in sixth grade, I do remember that. I got really into films, and one of the few films that I always saw laying around my house was Boogie Nights. And, you know, I was also an internet kid, so I looked it up and I saw the Ebert and Roper review, and they gave Ebert seemed to love it. Is it Ebert the right name? Yeah, you're right. Yeah, so Ebert seemed to like it a lot. I was like, I gotta see this film. So I checked it out, and it was one of my favorites I've ever seen.
Yeah, I definitely think when it comes to being an adolescent and getting into films for the first time, that Boogie Nights is definitely a gateway film.
Yeah, Boogie Nights and Pulp Fiction are two entry level.
Right, I remember back in like 98, my mom was working at a video store, and I remember just the buzz around Boogie Nights, and I remember thinking, wow, this movie, even as a kid, I was thinking, it must be very provocative, you know, it's about porn. I was like, oh my God, boobs, you know, that's like the little 12-year-old me thought. And then I didn't get to see Boogie Nights until I was 16, and that movie just cracked open the world of not just cinema in general and what a 27-year-old filmmaker can do, but it also cracked open the world of Paul Thomas Anderson. And I think I had seen Punch Drunk Love before that, but I didn't really know too much about film at that time, so I revisited Punch Drunk Love, and I thought it was really underrated, and also Adam Sandler's greatest performance. I have an anecdote about almost every one of his films, so I won't get into that, save that for another time. But
you know what? It's something we do gotta credit him for is he seems to bring the best out of every actor he works with.
Absolutely. I mean, whether if it's Tom Cruise in Magnolia, or Mark Wahlberg in Boogie Nights, or Philip Baker Hall in Sydney, I mean, he brings the best out of his performers, definitely.
Yeah.
I mean, the list goes on and on. There's Daniel Day-Lewis in There Will Be Blood, which I guess does now bring us into the Masters. As far as my expectation, I was just hoping to see, you know, obviously it was announced that Philip Seymour Hoffman was going to play the title role, which is the Master, who's also my favorite actor. And Joaquin Phoenix was going to make, this is his first film since I'm Still Here. And I was a big fan of that. And I didn't really become a Joaquin Phoenix fan until that film. Wasn't really such a big fan of Walk the Line or anything, but I'm Still Here was really transcendent for me. So I was prepared for a performance-driven movie, and really just kind of reinvigorating the careers of both those men. And I guess that was like my only expectation, because he had done it with Tom Cruise. He had did it with, you know, William H. Macy. So I couldn't wait to see that. When the trailers first came out, we'll just talk about two of the trailers, because there was about eight that came out before The Master was theatrically released, limitedly, might I add. There was the Was There a Fight trailer, and then there was the theatrical trailer that debuted the day before
The Dark Knight Rises.
The Dark Knight Rises. Tell me about what that was like for you.
I remember the first trailer, I was posting it like 20 times on Facebook. I'm pretty sure if you go back, you can see like 20 times I posted it. I thought it was really interesting because throughout my whole reading about this film, I never wanted to be spoiled, but I thought the film was supposed to be about like this this religious movie about cults and how it's dangerous or something like that. I knew he wasn't going to be coming at it in One Direction, but I thought it was supposed to be about cults. And when I saw the first teaser, I realized that it's about Freddie, who's played by Joaquin. And I didn't know that at the time, but I saw Joaquin and I knew he was the main character. And as soon as I saw the end, when he looks totally lost and he goes, "What fight?" I realized it's about the character already from the teaser. And that's what makes the teaser one of the best teasers I've ever seen. It just gives you enough to want to see the film. And heck, it might not even give you anything from the film.
Yeah, it teases. That's what teasers do, apparently. That's weird. No, but I mean, you made an interesting point where, you know, like the title role is called, you know, it's called The Master. Phil Hoffman was going to play The Master. And then you get pretty much no Philip Seymour Hoffman in that original trailer. And you kind of have to make the assumption that, yeah, Joaquin is going to be like the lead role. And he was. Did that come as a surprise to you?
A little bit. I was expecting him in, and this is going like way back before I knew the film. I was expecting it to be kind of a shared, thing. But you know, not that it's not shared in the film, but Joaquin really does quarterback the film throughout the whole movie.
Oh, definitely, yeah. I had heard that Paul Thomas Anderson had been wanting to work with Joaquin Phoenix for a long time. I think he even wanted to work with him during, like, Boogie Nights.
Huh.
But I guess it just never really happened. But it finally happened now, and boy, did it pay off in spades.
I can't even see Jeremy Renner playing the role, and I know he was originally casted.
That I heard about that. That would have been interesting.
I guess you wanted to do that. That would have been
very
Avengers.
Interesting, but I honestly don't want to see anybody else other than Joaquin Phoenix playing Freddie Quill.
And I'm not sure if I can say this is the best movie ever, but I'm just gonna say it flat out. I thought that was the best performance, not only this year, but one of the best. I'm saying one of the best, but I think it's the best performance I've ever seen. Everything he has to do for that movie is kind of amazing. The way he carries himself, and the interesting thing about Joaquin Phoenix in the movie is he kind of looks like he might be overacting in the beginning. When you see him, he's like, is he like overacting? He looks kind of too sick. He's sticking out his lips like Popeye, and he's just kind of like, it looks kind of weird. But then right away you see the depth to his character, and he does it all with his eyes, and he doesn't even have to say much. And I know this is an all-time great performance.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. I would totally say this is top three, either, you know, greatest performances of all time, but I can definitely say that's the most profound performance I've seen from a man or a woman in my life. I mean, like you were talking about his posture and just like his body in general, Joaquin created this character from scratch. I mean, from the feet up, he just created this character. When it comes to the voice and how his body moves,
how he reacts to certain words,
everything is just so. I mean, it really kind of just changed the way I look at actors. And if you're an actor or an aspiring actor, you have to see the master for both his performance and Philip Seymour Hoffman. They're doing the best work of their careers.
Yeah.
And even that's very evident in the teaser and in the trailer. I was very excited to see the teaser. It caught me off guard. I knew it would be coming up any week now during that time. I remember it happened, I want to say, like in June. And I was filming my movie at the time, and I remember stopping like my production and being like, okay, no, we all have to watch this together. And me and Perla Rodriguez saw it together, and I wanted to just see it 10 times in a row, but we had to keep filming. And so I'll never really forget that. It was really amazing. And just the look of it, even if I didn't know that it was going to be taking place in the 50s, early 50s, late 40s, even if I didn't know that, I could tell just from the look of the film, just the aesthetic of the film. Before we jump into Phil Hoffman, who we definitely need to jump into, I do want to talk briefly about the film aesthetic, the visual aesthetic of the film.
And the fact that it was shot in film.
It was shot on film, of course. Paul Thomas Anderson will always shoot on film. those are his words, not mine. And not only was it shot on film, but it was shot on 65mm, not your traditional 35mm or your Super 16 or something. It was shot on 65 using the same Panavision cameras that Stanley Kubrick used in 2001 A Space Odyssey. Now, a film hasn't been shot completely in 70mm since a narrative film, because of course I think Baraka was shot like in 70mm. I don't know the filmmaker's name of Baraka, but the same dude that did Samsara, sorry. Check those movies out. But the first narrative film to be shot on 65mm since Hamlet, like in the early 90s. So I didn't understand why.
Yeah.
I didn't understand why when I had read that, because those are typically used for epics, for your Lawrence of Arabias or your Ben-Hurs or whatever.
Yeah.
So hearing that Paul Thomas Anderson was going to do that on a film that was loosely based on Scientology, I didn't really know what to think of that. It just seemed like he was upping his scope from There Will Be Blood to The Master. But then when you watch The Master and you see how delicate and how tragic and how simple and beautiful it is.
And how the camera seems to be, it's the closest, you know, people say 3D is 3D. That's the closest I've ever felt 3D in a movie. I don't know, it sounds weird.
It seems like there's a window
instead
of a screen.
Yeah, and you're seeing you can people. See like all the cracks in their skin, their clothes, their dirt in the clothes, dirt in the nails. It was kind of It's not a dirty film, but you can see the detail in every single frame.
And that has a lot to do with the visual aesthetic that Paul chose to use.
It looks like a 50s film, you know?
Definitely. As opposed to like the Lawrence of Arabia landscapes, where it's like vast Sahara Desert and things, you get the landscape of Joaquin Phoenix's face.
And how...
And like you said, the lines and the cracks of his face, and that really transcends the performance. It turns a seemingly just intimate kind of film into really an epic. Yeah. It shouldn't be. It just shouldn't feel the way that it does, but it does because Paul made it so, just by using the format that he did. And I think that's something that we should definitely, it's definitely worth noting.
Yeah, and, you know, I knew the Blu-ray wasn't going to be as pretty looking. I mean, it still looks amazing, but if you didn't get to see it in 70mm, you missed the treat, you know?
You missed out big time. I mean, I think there's still only like 10 reels of The Master on 70mm. And those, it came to Texas, it came to Austin, and both of us got to see it in 70mm. Amazing, absolutely amazing. And I got to see it also in 35mm, and there is a difference. There's a big, giant difference. Mm. Now I've seen it on Blu-ray, and it's not the same. It's still a it's still a fucking luscious, just lush movie on Blu-ray. It looks amazing, but it's not the same as seeing it and feeling it and hearing the film roll in the theater. I mean, that was absolutely amazing.
Yeah, I've seen it in a few formats. I've seen it in 70mm, 35mm, 4K, and I saw it like in a regular digital screen. But it's an interesting film, and every version I see gives me something different visually. And I think obviously he meant it to see 70mm, but even when you see it like on a small Blu-ray TV, it kind of still has an amazing look to it.
Oh, definitely. It still feels epic. It still feels big. Yeah. I don't recommend watching it on your cellular phone, but if you did, I think it would still feel much bigger than what it should.
And there's a lot of close-ups in that film, and it's very... so you don't miss a lot of the... Like, it's not like done like giant...
like landscapes.
Landscape shots. Yeah, white shots.
There certainly are some, and they look amazing, but... the close-ups and the little quiet, personal, intimate environments just seem bigger. They just seem absolutely bigger. I love that about the visual of the movie, and it does separate it from his other films.
You know, our friend Andrew had written something about The Master, and he had probably the best reaction I've ever seen from anybody after a film. He was just kind of in awe, and he's just gotten out of surgery, and he demanded I take him to The Master. I was like, all right, dude, but you just got out of surgery, so rest. But he decided to go see it. And after the film, he was a mixture of laughing and crying and just in awe. He couldn't talk for like 5 minutes. It was kind of weird.
Wow, that's interesting. You know, I want to ask you, even though we're talking about the Blu-ray, which just came out, it came out 2 days after the Academy Awards, the 2012 Academy Awards, which came out 2013. And Joaquin Phoenix, Amy Adams, and Philip Seymour Hoffman, all three of them were nominated, and they all three lost, which is a shame.
But you know what's really interesting is I was surprised Amy Adams was nominated, because I thought she did an amazing role, but I just thought there wasn't enough of her for people to see the greatness in it.
Yeah, I think it was a fair nomination. I mean, it wasn't like it was Best Actress, it was Best Supporting Actress, and she is in a supporting role, so I think we get enough screen time from her, maybe 30 minutes. And the scenes that she's in are absolutely wonderful.
She kind of steals the scene for every season.
That's absolutely right. So even though we're talking about the Blu-rays, we'll get into the bonus features in a bit. But I want to ask you how your first initial theatrical response was to the film.
You know, I saw it...
You should really be in-depth about that, because I think it's a cool story.
Okay, well, 70mm, you know, I was... my friend Andrew had just texted me that the tickets are going on sale for the special screening in Austin. And I was like really excited because it wasn't going to come out for like another 2 weeks or something, maybe even three, I forgot. And I ordered the ticket, and so I was really excited because I didn't even know who was going to be there or what was going to be there. I just knew I had to be there early, and I had to wait in line, and I didn't care. I said to myself, I would never wait in line for another film, but I make the exception for The Master, of course. So as I was waiting in line, you know, it was kind of nerve wracking because they were kind of running late. And I was thinking, like, why are they running late? And I was there in the theater, and I didn't want to eat because I was just so nervous for the film. And it was running late, and I was like, I'm getting kind of frustrated. I was like, is it because there's more people in here than they were expecting? Like, are they dumb? Or is this getting mad? And they bring in a little stupid flippy flop chair next to me. And I was like, oh, great. Now this is going to invite everybody in and it's going to be too crowded. I'm going to be mad. And little did I know, the person that was going to be sitting next to me, he didn't sit there the whole time, but for the first 15 minutes of the film was Paul Thomas Anderson. Oh. And throughout the whole film, I was like a statue. I was like, wow. I'm not going to move.
Literally a foot away from you.
Yeah, he was like, where we are, that's where he was to me. And it was I was so nervous because he talked, like, he didn't even say much. He's like, hey, this is my movie. Hope you guys like it. You
know, what was the reaction like?
His reaction or my reaction?
No, his reaction. I mean, the consensus of, like, everybody in that theater.
You know,
I mean, you had to be a pretty diehard PTA fan to want to see The Master 2 weeks in advance.
Yeah. Right? You know, I think people were left kind of cold because they didn't know what they just saw.
Not after the movie, but before when he introduces it.
Oh, when he introduced it. It was just kind of like...
people were really respectful. I mean, I think I probably would have went nuts seeing
him. Yeah. A few people were just speechless, like me. Other guys were just like, oh, yeah, it's PTA. You know, he's like, a lot of people think he's the greatest director alive right now, and it's hard to argue that. So a lot of people were excited to see him, and he never seems to really like his fans, but he appreciates them. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of interesting.
Absolutely. Tell me more about the first time you were experiencing in the theater.
In the theater. Well, the film opens up with that beautiful ocean shot, you know? And as soon as I saw that, I was like, whoa. Mm-hmm. This is the prettiest looking film I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. In my head, and of course, like, I was kind of like, I'm not gonna like mark out over here, so I just kind of keep my cool. And the film kind of just goes, and you kind of see Freddy, and he's kind of doing his that's a pussy coming in a dick, and it's just it kind of starts off weird with Freddy, and you wonder where is it gonna go. So for the first few minutes, I was just kind of getting my feet wet with it, but as soon as I figured out who Freddy was, I was just in love from it. I was in love throughout the rest of the film.
Okay, and now you were saying that, like, initially that the response in the crowd was left kind of cold. How did you feel at the end of the film?
You know, when it ended, I was kind of fighting back tears because Paul Thomas Anderson had just made his way back. And I needed to talk to him because I was like, I'm not going to have any more chances to talk to this guy. So, I'm fighting back tears, but I cry really easily in films. And that scene with Freddy and him at the end, spoilers, by the way, when he says that last line, if we meet each other in another life, we would be mortal enemies. Mm-hmm. That almost like broke me down. And I'm kind of getting emotional here talking about it. But so I had to fight back the tears because there's one more scene after that. And it's kind of like a comic relief scene a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it was easy. So I had a few seconds to build myself back up. And of course, like, I think people were too nervous to talk to him. Mm-hmm. Because I'm not sure if people really liked the film or if they didn't like it.
Right.
So I think a lot of people were nervous because it was kind of weird. Because I was expecting them to do a Q&A. Because that seems to be the thing directors do after a film, you know?
True.
They didn't do one. And I was like, okay, people are leaving. I got to do this because there's going to be a crowd around them or something. And then a few people walked by him, and I was like, man, no one's going to talk to him. I got to talk to him. I go right up to him. It's like, hey, Paul, what's up? I started giggling like a fucking middle school kid. I feel like a loser. And he goes, oh, man, another thing. What do you think of the movie? I was like, I think I said it was really good. It was, I should have said something else, but I just said it was really good. Uh-huh. He's like, oh, man, glad you liked it. And he gave me like this smile, and I felt like I saw like Jesus Christ or something. I was religious for that 5 seconds.
Wow.
And, I felt like I should have said more to him, but I just couldn't. You just get nervous or something, you know? Because I've talked to celebrities, you know, it's part of my job. But there's a difference between this celebrity and somebody you look up to. Mm-hmm. And there's only a few guys I look up to, and one of them is Paul Thomas. And despite I know how little people respect him, Adam Sandler would be the other guy I'd be kind of nervous talking to.
Wow.
So, yeah, I just couldn't get out the words to him. But he looked kind of confused about the crowd, I think, looking back on it. I'm not sure. I think he was kind of disappointed in the crowd. Because I remember there was one moment in the film when someone drops the glass and he whispers to Tim League. Tim League's the owner of the Alamo Draft House. Oh, man, the guy must be frustrated at the film or something. And he says that as a joke, but every joke has a sense of realism. I think he was feeling the crowd wasn't liking it or something. I don't know.
Wow. That's too bad.
Yeah.
I feel like that may be how he feels about the movie in general. I mean, I wouldn't know, but yeah. I've seen enough interviews to think that...
He feels like he has to almost defend the film.
I don't know. I feel like he... I want to say, like, when he saw his own final cut, he must have thought, this is probably the best film I've ever made. And then he releases it, and it's... I don't know if he could have... predicted that it was going to be as...
Split.
As split as it was.
Especially,
and that's
like,
too bad.
Especially a film like that, because I ended up loving the film, but at the time, I was just kind of... It's kind of a film you have to put together a little bit. You got to give it some extra thought.
Absolutely.
So right afterwards, it's not a good thing to talk to the guy when you still don't know what to say about the film. And that's why I can just... Because I knew I liked it, because I thought it had the best performances I've seen, like, within watching it. Mm-hmm. But as in terms of, like, all the themes it carries, all the emotional weight it carries, mm-hmm. all the things that makes me think about, you have to give it at least a day, you know? I remember when I wrote the review for it, I had to think about it for a week. Because it was just that type of film.
Wow. That's really interesting, you know. I don't want to bring the podcast down by any means, but I, you know, was just as psyched as anybody to see the film. I did have immense high expectations because this is a director that has to top a masterpiece, that has to top a classic, that is There Will Be Blood. I didn't assume that he could. I just didn't. And I went to Austin. I was homeless. This is about the fourth weekend, and I had missed the viewing that you caught, which did premiere 2 weeks.
And I think it's kind of funny how you missed release. The film.
I missed it. I, you know, the trailers were coming out, and there was this one trailer that was specifically for the Austin Alamo Drafthouse premiere, and I didn't want to watch the trailers anymore because I was like, I'm going to see it in 2 weeks, and I skipped it. But had I seen it, I would have realized, oh, tickets go on sale for that showing 5 days from now or whatever, and I could have watched it, but I didn't, and that sucks. But so I had, you know, I was in a rough place myself, you know, watching it, and I do have to say that I took mushrooms right before I saw the movie. I knew that was going to be a gamble, but I took it anyways. And as I'm waiting in line for the film to come out at the Ritz, I see Richard Linklater. And I thought I was, you know, tripping or something at yeah. this moment. I asked my friend, I asked Dave, I was, you know, hey, like, is that Richard Linklater? He's like, I think so. And I go up to him, and Richard Linklater had just seen The Master. And I asked him, what did you think? And he was, you know, you gotta give me a while, man. He's like, I don't know. I there's a lot there. He's like, I don't know how I feel about it. So that already made me feel uneasy. So I go into the movie, and I have to say, with that opening shot with the water, like you were saying, I submitted. I mean, I tapped out. I said, fuck my expectations. I don't care. I'm in great hands. I just felt, now maybe it was the shrooms talking, but I do want to attribute just the credit to the film itself, not necessarily my biology, but I really just tapped out, and I said, you know what? This is a auteur. This is a filmmaker's filmmaker. This is a master, no pun intended. I'm not going to judge the film. I'm going to let it absorb me. And that's exactly what I did. I tapped out. I submitted to the film. And I just gave in to the craft of it. And I think I learned a lot just in that one viewing. I learned that a filmmaker is in complete control of every shot and how you're going to feel. I learned that actors, that the script almost doesn't even matter in a lot of ways. I learned countless things from watching that the Master the first time, and I felt so unbelievably fulfilled at the end of that screening. I felt full of life and light by the end of that.
That's actually a good way to talk about it, because I had that same exact feeling, and maybe I couldn't pinpoint it, but mm-hmm. there was a part of my life that I felt like was completed. And yeah. I know it sounds really weird, but yeah. I think it was destiny that I had to see that film.
And it's more so than like the baggage I'm taking to the film and the magic that I took to it, you know, being under the influence of mushrooms, and also having just met Richard Linklater, which was pretty fun. And also I had been waiting for this film for years. Minus all that, it was the film itself. It was yeah. the narrative. It was the story. It was the emotions that Paul created and constructed himself that really left me just transcendent. Like, it left me... I can't really explain it other than full. Like, it left me just full of light. I knew I was never going to see things the same after that.
Yeah, it kind of changed your view of movies in general.
It truly did.
I remember
it changed my view of filmmaking.
You know, I remember every film that came out after that until I think Django. I just couldn't take it serious. I was like, "What is this movie? I'm not gonna watch it." Or, "This movie's not as good." Or, yeah, I was kind of like that guy again, and I haven't been that guy since high school. But I was just kind of like, I was kind of like getting depressed a little bit because of how good that film was. Because I saw it like 3 times in theaters, maybe 4. And it's just one of those films where you just don't feel complete until you see something else that kind of shows you that there's more to movies, you know. But
there's more to movies and there's more to your life. Yeah. I mean, I sound really like a hippie, but that's truly, truly how I felt. Just instinctually, I got to go with my instincts. And there's one notion that I want to really hit, and this is going to throw us into the plot, which I really, really, really want to sink my teeth into. And that I had already heard the buzz, and you had mentioned it, that it was very decisive, is that the word?
Divisive,
excuse me. It was very divisive. Just the polarity of the response to that film was off the charts. I mean, you either loved it or you hated it, I had assumed from what I had read online. And even Roger Ebert gave the film 2 stars.
And he's been a big PTA fan.
He didn't. I want to say he declared There Will Be Blood one of the best films of the past 10 years.
He declared Magnolia one of the best films, period.
So this is a man that I thought if anybody would understand this movie, it was Roger Ebert. He gave it 2 stars, and I was kind of nervous about that. So when the film was over, I went up to my friend who was sitting right to my right, and both of us were just completely drained from the film.
Yeah, it's a very draining film. It's not
just
long.
Emotionally.
It's not a long film, but it fucking beat your ass a little bit.
Yeah, and I asked him, I was like, did you get it? And he was like, yeah. And we kind of talked about it really briefly, and I was like, okay, I guess you did get it. It's not just me, because it's very simple. It's very simple to get, and I feel there's a lot of greatness there to the film that anybody can recognize in terms of like the performance, and the music is fun, it's funky and memorable. Obviously the cinematography is lush and gorgeous, and you can sense that there's an auteur at work doing what he does best, and that there is a meaning behind everything. I just think it's a lot of people were lost in what the meaning was, but I felt really connected to it, and I thought the story was simple, and I think the story is as follows, and it's simply, here's Freddy, and can he get better? And the ending asks the question, did he get better? That's it. There are a lot of distractions in the film, such as the music and the tempo of the scenes,
great performances.
The performances that are, I know, you know, you said they could be maybe at first distracting, or maybe distracting isn't the word, but like a disarming.
Yeah.
Because
I think people were afraid of Freddy.
I think they were afraid, yeah. And people don't like to be made uncomfortable in general.
Yeah.
And the film is kind of an uncomfortable film because it's dealing with very delicate subject matter. You know what I mean? A guy coming back from the war, a guy that had a lot of baggage to begin with, who was mentally unstable, who's an alcoholic, who may even be a sex addict. That's a lot of deep shit to throw into somebody's lap in the first 3 minutes of the film.
Yeah.
I was ready for that, but I guess a lot of people weren't. The narrative is really simple, and I remember Ebert, this is one line from his review that I'll never forget. He said, he said that the film seems to be grasping at air. I don't know what it's trying to be, he says. I think the film knows exactly what it's trying to be, and I think the plot's really simple. It's just, does this man get better? Can he get better? And then cue in Philip Seymour Hoffman's character. He plays Lancaster Dodd. He plays the master.
And then throughout the whole film, you kind of ask yourself about questions about him. Is he a phony or is he real?
Yeah.
And I remember in my review, I said, I kind of copied off of Ebert a little bit, but I said, this film is 100% real. Like, you know, actually, Ebert might have copied off of me. But I was just thinking, you know, I'm not sure who his character is or if he's being a phony or not. But that relationship that he has with Joaquin Phoenix in the film, I never doubted it for a second. I'm not sure about you, but I just knew right away those guys were
were
kind of soulmates.
I think they're both disingenuous in their own way, just the way like people are in general. But I think, yeah, they truly are soulmates, and their relationship is unbelievably complex in the film. It's unbelievably real. Like, the thing that I relate to Lancaster's character and Freddy's character is their relationship, and I've had a relationship just as unstable and volatile as that.
Yeah.
You know, so I could really relate to it. They are soulmates. Even though Freddie is a liar and a drunk and alcoholic, Lancaster is the same thing, and I think that's part of the bond that brings them together. So I think a lot of people brought this baggage that is going to be an expose on Scientology and dive a lot deeper into, like, the mechanics and the, you know, like you said, off mic, It's kind of like what South Park did about Scientology and expose it for what it truly is or whatever.
Yeah.
Even though it's not as kooky as any other religion, they're all the same to me. Scientology and, like, I don't know, Mormons get, like, a lot of flack, but they're just as ridiculous as any other religion. And the cause is no different. So the motives don't really bother me, whether if Lancaster's being sincere or not, because that relationship is completely sincere and completely unconditional. And that's something you don't really see on film nowadays. I can't even think of a movie in the past 5 years that had a male and female relationship that I love just as much as I love the platonic heterosexual relationship of Lancaster and Freddie.
Yeah, there's several scenes in the film that are really powerful. You know, there's the one famous scene when they're doing the first processing scene, or the first processing. But you know, that scene was good. You get a lot out of it. Even to the point where Hoffman's kind of mumbling what Joaquin is doing, and you kind of get the feeling like this guy really wants to help this guy. But the one scene where I knew these guys loved each other in a totally, dude, I need you in my life, is when Joaquin's character first gets out of jail, and he plays with them like he's like they're little kids, yeah. Or, you know,
and missed them.
Yeah, he missed them. Like that's his best friend or something, you know. Mm-hmm. And people compare it like a dog and a human and a master, but I never got that about them. Mm-hmm. Because they kind of both seem to learn from each other
in
a weird way.
I think if they're you know, that whole dog master dichotomy, I think they're both dogs.
They're both animals, yeah.
And, yeah, and they, you know, and that's like one of the big themes of the movie, is that man is not an animal, yet they both kind of, you know, submit to their animal instincts sometimes. There's that infamous moment where the skeptic is questioning Lancaster's method, and he says, you know, if you know the question, why do you ask, pig fuck? And like the Freddy in him kind of comes out. He's just as human as Freddy,
and he likes to drink like Freddy,
and he likes to drink, and he can hang with Freddy, you know what I'm saying? These are things that I think are simple and they're on the surface that a lot of people just overlooked, and I can't understand. You know, I'm not saying I have the film figured out. I don't know if I have any film figured out, for that matter. I don't want to figure out a film. I want to be able to enjoy it for the rest of my life and see it, you know, once a year, maybe even more. But The Master, to me, it will always be a giant injustice how in 2012 it was overlooked, not just by the Academy, whatever. Paul will always be overlooked because they can't recognize true greatness sometimes, whether if it's, you know, Amy Mann's, you know, song and Magnolia that got overlooked by fucking Phil Collins. That's weird. Or if it's, you know, the best screenplay for
Boogie Nights
or There Will Be Blood. I mean, or even best director for There Will Be Blood. That's not fair. I don't want to get into that. But even when it comes to the gen pop, when it comes to the audience in general, I think The Master just falls on deaf ears. And a lot of, I think it goes over people's heads. Why do you think that is? I want to get to that.
I've been trying to figure it out forever. It's kind of tough to explain. Because I think maybe people were going into it expecting, like it maybe one of his earlier films. I remember I read a review about how someone said that his best friend just died. And it was kind of like dung tongue-in-cheek, but he was totally serious about it. And he was talking about how Paul Thomas Anderson, when he saw Boogie Nights, was the greatest film he's ever seen. Mm-hmm. And that this guy's going to be his favorite director forever. And he says, the more this guy progresses, the less he sees in his original best friend. I think maybe people are just seeing a director maturing a little bit too fast for them.
That's very interesting. That's very interesting. I haven't really articulated that way. You know, it's kind of hard to not compare PTA to Stanley Kubrick, but I can't help it. You know, Stanley Kubrick made films that weren't really understood till 10 years later, at least. 2001 is one of them. I don't even know if people really laughed out loud at what's that bomb one? I'm sorry, Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah,
I don't know if people really laughed out loud and considered it the comedy that it is today. Even, you know, Clockwork Orange and Barry Lyndon, like a lot of people didn't recognize those films as greatness when they came out. They were unsettled by it, and now people will tell you, oh my goodness, The Shining is a masterpiece, so on and so forth. Even Eyes Wide Shut, a semi-recent example, you know, in modern film history, I don't think anybody really understood how amazing that movie really was
until
after the fact.
Yeah.
Well, 10 years after the fact. Is it a shame that The Master's going to be put in that elite class? No, it's not a shame, but I do wish that it was received with as much not just praise, but understanding that, like, there will be blood dead. Because the narrative of The Master is very simple.
Yeah. It's probably, even be his most simple film.
But I never really thought of it that way, like you said. Just the progression and evolution between, I mean, it's literally like light speed. I mean, I think he just evolved kind of too quickly for some people. I haven't really thought of it that way. But the film is definitely, I think, going to be a gateway film for the new level of storytelling going into this 21st century. I think, yeah, that movie's, The Master, that is going to change the way people view films, expect films, and how the craft of a narrative is going to change. It's not necessarily a traditional three-act structure, the film.
Yeah, and
I think that's going to change, and it has a lot to do with
I consider myself, I always try to root myself in who I was when I was younger, because I never really want to change that, my film taste. I mean, in a weird way. But I'm not a fan, as you know, of Terrence Malick. But I can see the Malick influence in this film. And I can see the influence of other films in this film. And I think he's taking filmmaking to a level that I really haven't even seen. Because people were trying to compare this to Tree of Life. But it's not really like that.
I think that's a cop-out.
Yeah.
I think everybody's going to compare a movie they don't understand to Tree of Life.
Yeah.
That's not fair. That's a cop-out.
Yeah.
People got to work harder, I think, when it comes to a film. I'm going to digress just for a second, because this is a revelation that occurred to me as I was watching The Master for the first time, in which I, like I said, just submitted to the film and let it wash over me like a wave. It changed the way I look at movies in general. Now I trust directors. I mean, I went back and I saw Zack Snyder's Sucker Punch. Now, I went back to, this just happened yesterday, I went back to my Facebook, because you know, you can go back during the timeline. I went back to something I said in March 2011, and I said, you know what? All you motherfuckers that are going to watch Sucker Punch, you guys are just throwing your money away. It's a waste. I'm not going to watch that garbage. The trailer looked stupid. I was that ignorant 2 years ago. I saw the director's cut on Blu-ray, and it blew me away. It was truly great. That movie was fun. That movie was smart, and that movie didn't explain itself. You know, there's going to be a Lost Filmwork episode where you and I covered Christopher Nolan.
Yeah.
We had already taped that one. And you know, like Filmwork on Facebook, and you'll be able to hear that one where we cover Inception, and we talk about how that's a film that explains itself every second, so you always kind of know what's going on. Sucker Punch doesn't do that, and I appreciate that about that film, and I probably wouldn't be able to even understand my own level of appreciation if it wasn't for The Master, and if it wasn't for understanding that directors, true auteurs, are in command of every shot and of every note of the film, and they know what they're doing, and there's a purpose for everything. And I also learned that you never, as an audience, should expect a film to meet you where you're at. That's completely selfish and narcissistic and also unrealistic. You need to meet the film where it's at. And that requires a little bit of work, and I think people are just copping out when they say this movie's a little too Terrence Malick for them and it's too Tree of Life, because they don't want to put in the effort to go to a dark place or even to a deep place and to a relatable place to explore themselves while watching a movie that's as complex as The Master.
Yeah, most definitely. I think the character Freddy is not your typical protagonist. He doesn't seem to be looking for anything. Mm-hmm. He doesn't seem to have something, a goal, and I think that confuses people when you see someone that doesn't have a goal.
That's also very interesting. Yeah.
And he's not even like reflecting on his life. I mean, there's scenes where he does reflect, but he's not ashamed of whatever he's done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's so interesting, because it's not like a typical hero's journey, but it's not like a typical art film.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that I just can't even explain. But Freddy is
I would explain it, you know, it's not my duty to explain what it is, but it's not unlike real life.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Where you were 3 years ago and now, there's a massive difference, but it happens with little changes.
Yeah.
Not these, you know, life-changing events where there's an epiphany and you say, voila, this is what it is, you know, or eureka.
Yeah.
That happens in movies. This didn't happen in The Master.
And I think that confused people.
And I think people kind of expect that, because a lot of, you know, typical studio films are
not even studios, like even indie films.
Even indie films, studio films, and even television are conditioning audiences to expect a certain structure and to expect catharsis at some points. But we don't get that in real life. You know, all of Paul's films have always reminded me of, like, just a magnifying glass on real life. Even though Magnolia is very heightened and very melodramatic at some points, I don't mean that as a negative, it's very true.
Yeah.
You know, like a Frank T.J. Mackey, that's a very real, relatable person with daddy issues. And see, even someone, you know, like a Melora Walters in that movie is very relatable. You know what I'm saying?
I always said that
all his characters are very relatable.
I always said the most realistic dialogue I've ever heard. Yeah, and people always say, like, you know who writes good dialogue? You know who writes good dialogue? And I feel like Punch Drunk Love is very underrated in that aspect.
Definitely.
Because maybe it's because we're Mexicans or something, but I feel like that's how everyone talks.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah.
Thanks. Yeah. Now everyone knows we're Mexican. Just kidding. Go ahead.
Everyone turned off the podcast. It's too late. But I'm saying, like, you know, the fact that, like, everybody in the family kind of makes fun of me. Or not, they make fun of everybody, but they make fun of someone in particular. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And there's one scene where I just can't forget it. It's when he's talking to Lena for the first time. Is that her name?
Lena.
And he's just talking about a radio host. Mm-hmm. Something so stupid as a radio host. It's not as cool as Star Wars. It's not as cool as Big Macs. Mm-hmm. He's talking about a radio host.
That means a lot to him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that's how real life is, because we can talk about something so stupid and that's what means a lot to us.
Paul Thomas Anderson's writing will never get the credit that it deserves.
Yeah.
I think the trick in writing is writing what you're unable to say.
Yeah.
And his characters go through that. And that's tricky, and that takes hard work. And I definitely respect that. And I feel maybe we might be talking about the craft a little too much. Yeah. But this is film work, baby, and that's what we're going to do. But to the casual Gen Pop audience who are conditioned to see a cookie-cutter formula when it comes to a movie, when they get something like The Master, I almost feel like they need a narrator to tell them, and then Freddy traveled over here and then came back to England to see Lancaster Dodd
10 years ago.
Yeah, I think they almost need that to understand what's going on.
You know what this movie really reminds me of and helped me appreciate it a little bit more? And I'm not going to compare the two because they're two of my favorite things, but Mad Men, mm-hmm. I feel kind of is almost the same way. It's a little bit... Mad Men's a little bit more TV-like.
Oh, it's episodic, of course.
Yes. But Mad Men's the same way with Don Draper. You see the first episode of the first season, like whatever's going on now, and he's still kind of almost that same guy. And that's what.
Sure.
And yeah. I think that's how life is, and I think that's why I gravitated to Mad Men and absolutely. Why I love The Master.
You know, that's a great point. And also, Mad Men is amazing. And it kind of deals with around this the same kind of man. The same kind of man from that generation, even though I think Don Draper... This is like the Korean War.
Yeah.
And just, you know, the beginning of Vietnam. It's still post-World War II.
Yeah.
And that same kind of man is still there. So I think the films are kind of relatable.
And they're both kind of alcoholics.
And they both, that was the way at the time, man. That Ernest Hemingway time. I do want to address the critical response from most people that, you know what? I don't go to a film to think. I don't want to think. I just want to be entertained.
Yeah.
What would you say? What would be your rebuttal for a response like that?
If thinking is not entertaining, mm-hmm. then I don't know what is. Because I mean, to be entertained, I don't want to see like explosions or whatever. And I know that's like a cop out answer, but I don't want to see explosions. I don't want to see simple storylines because that doesn't really have me thinking. And what I do want to see is characters that are dealing with something, because that's what life is, and that's what I think is entertaining.
What if people want to escape away from their life?
You know, the
escapist audience that just wants to be entertained.
I mean, then they can feel better that they're not Freddy.
I mean, that's. I think at the very least, the film is visually gorgeous to look at, and also I think
the
there's a lot of comedy in the performances that could sustain an audience. I mean, I took my mother to see this film, and she dug it. You know what I'm saying? But I know I have a friend who's my age who just tuned out after the second minute of the film. He saw Freddy humping a sandwoman and he was done. He fell asleep. He snored. I mean, this is a guy that fell asleep during The Master. He fell asleep during Skyfall. I mean, there's no appeasing certain amount of people. You know what I'm saying? So to that type of audience that's going to say, hey, I wasn't entertained, things like that, I think they need to be more in tune to their emotions. I know that's hippie-like, and that sounds very, you know, peace, love, and rock and roll, man, or whatever. But I truly think,
you know what,
if you've ever been in love and let somebody go or ran away from somebody, you can relate to The Master.
Yeah, and it's that simple. I think what makes The Master, how can I say this? What makes The Master even more, I think, for a population is the discussion it can bring up. Because we didn't even agree with the film.
Initially.
We kind of came up two different thoughts.
You know, I should talk about my initial read of the finish of the film.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, there's that amazing ending where Phil Hoffman sings and serenades a Freddy.
What you convinced me that he's trying to get Freddy to remember him for the rest of his
life. Of course, yeah. Because one of the things that Freddy remembered and that he holds onto this memory so dear is his memory of Doris singing to him. So Lancaster does the same thing. And I think that's a nice bookend. And then you cut to Freddy's in England. He makes love to this English woman. And then cut to the final image of the movie, where he's laying back with the Sandwoman, and it's a flashback of when he was on the beach with his fellow Navy comrades. And my initial read of the film was very melancholy. I was sad because it appeared to me that Freddy didn't change at all. He just went back
to, and that was a big criticism
to being very damaged. Now, it wasn't a criticism to me, like, of the craft of the film or how it affected me. It was still like a 10 out of 10 for me. But that was my read of the finish, and you kind of had a different read that sparked a pretty decent conversation. Do you remember?
Yeah. I always thought it was interesting in the beginning of the film, and you know, PTA is going to do this because he's like 10 levels ahead of everybody. Mm-hmm. He's with that chick, and they're kind of making out, and they're kind of kissing. He's playing with her tits a little bit, and he goes, "We're going to go out later on tonight." And as he does that, you see he's knocked out. He just can't have a relationship with somebody because he just drinks too much. And he has to drink his poison. And he's not drinking real alcohol. I mean, like, real drinks. He's drinking, like, hardcore shit.
Paint thinner.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And rocket fuel.
I mean, someone has just died drinking his stuff.
Exactly.
So he knows it's damaging his body. However, at the end, though, he is at a bar. He's in a public place, which is weird because Freddy is often, like, too
antisocial.
Antisocial a little bit, yeah. And he can't even talk to people. He's kind of like, he talks to them through sex almost in the beginning of the film. Any woman, he has to see him naked a little bit. Mm-hmm. And this chick, he kind of like takes her to her place. He's with her. And then he says the line from Dodd, like, "I'm going to give you a quick thing. What's your name?" And mm-hmm. he's just having fun with her. And that's when I realized
an actual connection, yeah, with another person.
Yeah. And it's not, I'm not even saying they're like in love or anything. Mm-hmm. But that little change is enough for me to see that Freddy didn't get like all the way better, mm-hmm. but he's not drinking the poison anymore, mm-hmm. and he's able to have sex with this girl when mm-hmm. the first time he was with somebody, he just knocked out. Mm-hmm.
And then if you put the track Changing Partners, that the final song in the master, and you put that on top of the scenery, he's changing partners from like Lancaster to this new level in his life. Yeah, when you had mentioned that to me, I was like, holy crap, he did get better.
Yeah.
And then I felt better about Freddy in general. I was like, oh, in a way, it is kind of a happy ending, or as happy as it can be, yeah. Anyways. And this goes back to the film being as challenging as it is, and as thought-provoking as it is, and provocative as it is. It inspires a dialogue to talk about this film with other people.
And
at the very least, if you're going to go out Friday night and to escape your kids and everything like this, and you want to be entertained, at least you can go back home and change the dialogue between you and your significant other.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? You get to have something else to carry with you. At the very least, having an engaging conversation.
And you bring back a good point about him playing with the Sandwoman again as a flashback. Mm-hmm. And I saw it as almost as
a contrast, like a juxtaposition, yeah. Before and after.
Type. Yeah, almost. But even then, like, it was so much more peaceful because in the beginning you kind of feel weirded out by him.
Yeah.
And you feel at peace with him at the end.
See, that's the thing that's really amazing. I remember you pointed that out to me of how in the beginning you're creeped out. You know, it's disturbing to see him kind of
just like
violating that. The Sandwoman. It makes you feel uncomfortable. It's unsettling.
He masturbates right afterwards, yeah.
Exactly. And then go back to the end, it's charming in this sad way. It's still melancholy, but it's beautiful, and you realize that Freddy, all he ever wanted was a connection. He wanted to feel better. He wanted a woman to love, and he wanted to be loved. He needed that connection. So when they show that final shot at the end, it really does make me feel like, wow, that's all he ever wanted. And it is much more peaceful and somber the second time you've seen it, knowing the context of who Freddy is now.
And this is the first deleted scene we're going to talk about, but there's a deleted scene where he's with the woman again. Mm-hmm. And he knocks out when he's with her in the car.
Yeah.
And that kind of helps me feel better because I wasn't sure if I was just lying to myself to say mm-hmm. Freddy's getting better. But you can see, like,
who he is. I wasn't sure if you were too clear if you said this on the podcast clear enough, but Freddy never has sex with a woman until the end.
Yeah.
It's almost like if Paul's saying in a weird way, he's earning the...
he's almost like a child.
Almost. Like, yeah, he's becoming mature enough to get there.
Yeah.
Because he knocks out with that girl in the beginning. And he can't have sex with anybody throughout the whole film. But he's sex nuts. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? He is obviously, you know, arguably anyways, like a sex addict. It's always on his mind. Sex is always on his mind, whether it comes to the Rorschach tests or that scene where Dodd's dancing and he envisions just the women naked in the film. And finally, he gets with the girl at the end. I mean, that's almost like the Adam Sandler movie template where, like, the guy gets the girl at the end. Freddie does kind of get a girl at the end. And more so, he gets an emotional connection with another person. Yeah. And I don't know why that kind of just went under the bus for a lot of people.
I saw a lot of people that didn't even talk about it, the ending. And I remember I was talking to a friend of mine on Facebook. His name is Michael. And he's a really great film fan.
Hi, Michael.
Yeah. And he kind of talks to me how that ending just meant so much to him. And I was like, okay, I'm glad that I'm the only one that didn't see, like, the happy ending in it. Or not even the happy ending, but just the ending, like, having closure. Because every fucking review I saw was, well, the film is, you know, it's a... doesn't really go anywhere, and the character doesn't really change, and by the end you wonder, like, why are we in this, like, tedious ride? And not only is not a tedious ride, but I remember when I first saw the film, I thought the film was going to end with Freddy riding off in the sunset. And as generic as that sounded, I would have liked that.
I would have been fine with that too.
Yeah, so it's very interesting how people read it, because I think if the movie ended that way, the movie probably would have been better received.
It would have been understood, but it wouldn't have been... Cause we would have missed out on, like, 20 minutes of gold, or at least 30 minutes of gold.
Because my two favorite scenes in the film were after that.
Which are them?
The
serenade?
The last scene with Freddie and Dodd is one of the greatest scenes I've ever seen between two people. And it's even better than the processing scene that everyone likes. Mm-hmm. But that scene is so emotional and so raw. And it's you see these two guys who are pulling apart, and it's almost like I haven't felt that way since Eternal Sunshine, where you see these guys breaking up and you go like, no guys, you guys are great together, don't do anything.
Exactly.
And it's so funny because they're not even like in a sexual relationship, I don't know, just two friends and
two soulmates.
Yeah, soulmates, there you go. And it's just like, you guys belong together, like, you guys should be hanging out, like, you guys complete each other in a weird way. Yeah.
What's the second scene?
And the second scene is the very next scene after that, and then he goes like, Doris Day, the actress, and he just seems so disappointed. And then it's not my second favorite scene in the film, but it's probably my second favorite line, when he goes, when is the character, because Freddie has a girlfriend in the movie, or you don't know, like, if it's his girlfriend, but it's the chick that he always goes back to. Mm-hmm. And finally at the end he tries to go look for her and she's married, and then the mom's like, well, you want me to give you a dress, you can write a letter. He's like, a letter? No. He just seems so disgusted by it and so disappointed by it.
Yeah. And I think, because he knows that he messed it up.
Yeah. And you can see how much that meant to him, because he has several scenes when he just snaps, either he kind of breaks down, or in the beginning when he talks about breaking down, it's such a powerful scene at the end.
Definitely. I don't know how that could be lost with people. I mean, like I said, if you've ever loved anybody, if you ever let somebody go, if you ever ran away from somebody, if you ever had something that you've regretted, you have to relate to Freddie. Freddie's much more relatable than I think people give him credit for. You don't have to be an alcoholic and drink jet fuel, or ship fuel, or whatever, or gasoline, or paint thinner, or Lysol to understand Freddie.
In a weird way, I felt like I was Freddie's best friend in the film, and I didn't want to see anything bad happen to him. And I remember the first time I saw it, I thought he was going to die in that motorcycle scene, and I felt scared, and I was scared out of my mind, the most scared I've been in a film forever. And I was like, don't die, Freddie.
You know, you take the attributes of Freddie Quell in the movie, you know, alcoholic, arguably sex addict, psychotic, hallucinatory. If you were to take all those qualities, that is usually the makeup of an antagonist in any other film.
Yeah.
And this is a guy that you love, or at least that you fall in love with. You know, I mean, he's still charming, he's still adorable, he's still harmless, like, in these weird ways. He's very delicate. That's something that you can only do with, like, that you can only get across from, like, the auteur of a Paul Thomas Anderson to make a character so kind of lovable in this weird way. Like you said, you didn't want him to die. In any other film, he would have been the villain. He would have been the bad guy, and he would have deserved his quote unquote comeuppance. But in this film, you unconditionally fall for him.
And then, and to not take away anything from Hoffman, I think I was going for Hoffman to try to.
I think we should definitely be talking about Phil Hoffman's character.
Yeah,
I think we've covered Freddy well.
I can talk about Freddy for like a year.
So can I? I mean, he is the. I mean, we do see the movie through his eyes.
Yeah, and you have an interesting theory about that, where you think the whole film is in his inner eyes.
I think that he's an unreliable narrator, and we're seeing the film through his eyes. I mean, there's not a scene where that he's not in. There's a couple, you know, there's that, infamous Amy Adams handjob scene. I think that's in Freddy's head, because before that you have the go roving scene, you know, the roving, a roving, which obviously he's hallucinating because he's, you know, drinking his potion and things like this. And then you cut to that handjob scene. I think that's his projection of how he views their relationship. And then in the next scene after that handjob, Amy Adams wakes him up.
Yeah.
That seems to me, just with the dissolve going into that musical sequence to the handjob, it seems like Paul's trying to say this is a part of the same consciousness. To me anyways, I definitely can't tell people that's how you should read it, and I would never tell people that's how you should read the film. That's how I read it. That's how I feel it's presented to me. And there's, you know, other little scenes where it's like, okay, obviously that's in Freddy's head. Obviously, you know what I'm saying?
Because there's a scene where Amy Adams is kind of barking like a commander.
Yeah, yeah. She seems very...
and she isn't like that.
Militant.
Yeah.
And you know, yeah, it's that scene where she's saying, we'll never dominate our environment unless we attack, you know what I'm saying? It sounds militant. It sounds not unlike something that Freddy would have been ordered back when he was in the war. And then what's the next scene? He goes and he attacks. Freddy wasn't in that room when he heard that conversation. I think that's also a hallucination that he's taking him with him. That's just me personally. But as far as the movie being aimless and things like that, I definitely don't see it.
I can't even imagine it. I've seen this movie like so many times. Mm-hmm. It could be called a lot of things. I just don't see it as aimless. I just can't. I refuse to.
And I've seen my fair share of nebulous filmmaking, like Tree of Life, and like other films that don't really want to declare themselves of a narrative. And they're very, just like I said, just nebulous and kind of... They are hard to grasp. And I've seen those films too, and I like them too. They're fine. But The Master is not one of those. It's not conventional, sure, but this is a filmmaker that's trying to push himself. Like you said, he evolved, and I think he evolved. You know, I think he skipped a couple of numbers and just went, you know, to a whole different just level. And that evolution, you got to respect that. And going back to Lancaster Dodd, Philip Seymour Hoffman's character, who's the title character in the movie, The Master, far more complex than I think people want to give him credit for, jumps off the page. Phil does so much with this character that I wouldn't have necessarily expected, you know, with his whole Orson Welles type of voice, just the bravado, just the presence that Lancaster has. It's something that I've been wanting to see Phil Hoffman have for a while, you know what I'm saying? He's a great supporting actor. He was wonderful in Capote, in which he won an Academy Award for, and he headlines that movie. But to see him have what I like to call the God Dick in this movie, where he's, you know, the commander of this film, was really fun for me to see. And he was really downplayed in the trailer, so every scene he's in is just, it's just amazing.
Yeah, there's one scene early on where you kind of see how great he is as an actor, and it's probably the processing scene. That's like his first major scene. Mm-hmm. And you see his eyes, and it's like he's following every little movement of Freddy. Mm-hmm. And he does that all with his eyes, and it's kind of, he has like the lights in his eyes, and mm-hmm. you can just see like his he's almost dancing with Freddy in that scene, and yeah. It's one of the best.
You parts. See unconditional love in Phil Hoffman's eyes when it comes to how he carried Lancaster's character.
Yeah, and it's he's just.
I mean, Phil Hoffman's been my favorite actor for quite some time. I loved him in this movie called Love, Liza, which his brother, I think, wrote for him. I love even his little small character in Almost Famous. He's great in little bit parts. I loved him, even though I know you're not a big fan of Synecdoche, New York, but I loved him in that movie.
He was good in Boogie Nights.
Wonderful in Boogie Nights. Probably my favorite Paul Thomas Anderson character is Scotty. I mean, I say that with no irony. I just have such immense sympathy for how Phil delivers that character. Now, I saw the movie four times in theater, three times 70mm, one time 35. I've seen the movie 10 times since it came out, and one thing that kind of surprises me is I've also read the script, and I want to say the script that I read was like one of the first drafts. Like it's not the version that they shot, even though there's a lot of scenes in that script that did make the movie. I don't think it explicitly says in the script that their relationship is going to be one of soulmates, one of just unconditional love. I think that's something that must have just happened out of the actors. I think that mutual respect between Joaquin and Phil just transcended to the screen, and then Paul knew he had to capture it and ended up using the takes that were just so immensely filled with respect and love that really kind of carries the film. I don't know if that was in the script. I don't know if that was always the intention. I know Paul Thomas Anderson has been asked, you know, how much of the movie that was in your head is on screen. I think he said like 85%, and that's great. He did make the movie he wanted to make, but he also made a movie that I didn't expect to be as beautiful as it was in terms of like the relationship. Now, I feel like we're treading the same old ground here, but that relationship goes overlooked. I think people will tell you about, you know, every Ryan Gosling chick flick, and yeah, you know, whether it's Rachel McAdams or Emma Stone, like those relationships, those are totally forgettable. And I'm not just saying that, they are. Even to a well more wider received relationship between like Summer and Tom and 500 Days of Summer. Is that what it's called? 500 Days of Summer?
Yeah.
Even that relationship to me was completely forgettable, but you go to these platonic male heterosexuals that are truly soulmates. And like you said, not really since Joel and Clementine from Eternal Sunshine have I really wanted these two people to stay together because they love each other. There's so much, they have so much in common. They're so complex. They even go through like false little breakups, like in the jail scene where like, I'm fucking done with you. Like all that shit. I've had that in my real life where I'm just like, I'm done. I don't want to talk to you ever again. I mean, that's what I feel Phil really says. I think that's where it comes from when he says, if you leave here, I never want to see you again. I mean, I've been told that, you know, I never want to see you again. I've told women that. To see that between two amazing actors is unforgettable. And yeah, they challenged each other. They rose to greater heights because of each other. I mean, Phil Hoffman, I think we'll never get the credit that he truly deserves. He's absolutely amazing in that movie. He channels just even this unprecedented presence to that film that only he could do.
And it's funny because everyone kind of wants to write him off as a phony in the film, and then like his real self is the person that says pig fuck. But I think there's so much more into his character, and it's
I think his heart's in the right place. Yeah, and he obviously wants to help people,
and he does want to help people. And I think he feels threatened that everybody wants to not see him help people. I don't think he thinks he's wrong. I don't think he thinks he's scamming people. Mm-hmm. And I think he honestly wants to help Freddy, and he's sure he maybe is making up some crazy ideas, mm-hmm, like touching the wall back and forth, mm-hmm, which is one of the best scenes in the film, mm-hmm, because everyone says like it's torture, and that's what the film is.
I think it's rehabilitation.
Yeah, and it's like he's doing these I don't want to say groundbreaking experiments, but he's doing these experiments to see like what Freddy could do for him, or where Freddy is to him, and
also trying to go over his patterns so Freddy can become aware of them and realize that this is ridiculous and things like this, so he can better himself.
Yeah,
ultimately.
And then Freddy even says to him like, "I can leave whenever I want," but he keeps on doing it. And I think that just shows you how much respect he has for the master. Mm-hmm. And there's some good deleted scenes in the film where you kind of see their relationship even better. And it's kind of weird.
There's talking about the Blu-ray, which we are reviewing, there's a 20-minute just deleted scene sequence called Back Beyond that everybody has to see. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's canonical to the film. Like, you need to see it to understand it. I would not say that. If you already appreciate it, I think you'll appreciate what it has to offer.
It's kind of like its own little short film.
It's its own little thing. And I think it's obvious why those scenes are left out of the film, but it's a must-watch if you appreciate the world that Paul Thomas Anderson created of the film, his own universe. If you appreciate that, then go and watch that. Even watch that 58-minute documentary of John Huston, the Let There Be Light. That was really telling and heartbreaking to watch. And it's really, for those that can't sympathize for Freddy, should watch that documentary.
Yeah, and then the behind-the-scenes thing is probably the most interesting.
That was really cool, too.
Yeah.
An unguided message.
Yeah.
I have true transcendent respect for Paul Thomas Anderson and the master. I mean, I really thought he peaked when it came to The Robot Blood. I thought he hit the ceiling. He broke that glass ceiling and built another story on top of that. I'm not saying that The Robot Blood is lesser now because of it. The fact that all these films remain under his belt, that's amazing. Yeah. This man has never made a dud and just continues to explore and
keeps challenging
and push himself and us too, audience.
And it's so weird because guys like us, we're not regular film fans, and we feel challenged by every new film he makes.
That's right.
So I can only imagine, like, the general population who don't see, like, over 100 films a year, you know?
Yeah.
It's got to be tough to see something like The Master with it being so cold.
I will never let go. I'll always have a little chip on my shoulder for the lack of just hands-down response that the film deserved. Yeah. I will always have a chip on my shoulder, and I will always tell people to watch this film. I mean, it just went up there for me in terms of, well, then you should watch this film, you know, because if you understand the film, then you'll understand me. Like, that's how personal I take the film, you know what I'm saying? I think we should be wrapping up here pretty soon. Is there any last things that you wanted to talk about that you think people should hear and should know about The Master?
I think the film is really simple, and people should go into it like that. And I think the characters are really complex, and maybe that's what confuses people. It's a character piece, but it's a double character piece. And I think even though we focused a lot on Freddy in this one podcast, Dodd is an interesting character, and he does have a lot of meat inside of him. Mm-hmm. And he's not the phony that you probably think he is in the film, but he's not the god he thinks he is in the film. And mm-hmm. that's really interesting. And Amy Adams gives an underrated performance. And she carries this doubt in her look, and she looks scared of Freddy. And I think everyone's afraid of Freddy. And I think people see Freddy as like the teenage boyfriend who's older than Dodd.
Exactly.
So
exactly. Yeah.
So everyone's afraid of him. And I think Amy Adams is the anchor behind everyone's doubt.
Absolutely.
And there's a great performance by the son-in-law.
I can't remember his name.
Yeah.
But he plays, oh my gosh, I can't remember his name.
Yeah, well, the son-in-law, he's like a perfect yes man. He believes mm-hmm. everything. Yeah, he believes everything Dodd is saying. Mm-hmm. The daughter has a few interesting scenes. The son has one of the most famous scenes in the trailer when he's like, everything he says is made up.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone adds something to this film. And every frame and every line is there for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And I love it. And I think it's a film that changed my life.
Definitely. I mean, I can't really say anything better than that. As an audience member, as a fan, and as a mark, it exceeded my expectations and gave me everything that I want in a film. There was much more emotion than I expected. It's you know, arguably his most emotional film, and his most mature in that weird way.
Mm-hmm.
It's very brave. I see so much courage in the characters and so much just courage in the filmmaking. Like, he has so much belief in his own skill and confidence in his own craft, and it's there. Like I said, as an audience, I recognize all that, and it gave me everything I wanted in a movie. As a filmmaker, not only did it challenge me, but set the bar extremely high, but it taught me something. It teaches me something every time I watch it. I learn something new every time I see it. If for those of you that are listening to this and you like the Film Work page on Facebook and you love film and you're looking into pursuing film as your life, as your vocation, The Master is something you should definitely study. It has so much to offer. And where the film draws its education from, you need to pursue. I mean, we saw John Huston's Let There Be Light. Like, I learned so much from that. I learned so much from Paul's influences and so forth. I mean, he really gives back in that way, whether you're conscious of it or not. I will always take away what the film taught me and what it teaches me about people and how it shined a mirror in my face and how I run away from my own problems too. I will always give The Master and Paul Thomas Anderson credit for showing me that and teaching me that.
And we're gushing about the film. I wish there was something negative we can say about the film.
Let me think. Let's think of some negative things.
I wish the Blu-ray had commentary.
I wish the Blu-ray had commentary. I don't know what he could say about it.
No, maybe the cinematographer was in the commentary. Maybe something like that.
Something like that. Negative things. I want to be completely objective.
I'm trying to be fuck.
There's no such thing as I've only given one movie a complete 100 out of a 100. But I would say there's no such thing as a perfect film. You know, I have nothing bad to say about it.
Yeah,
and I don't want to sound like we're two Paul Thomas Anderson kiss asses.
Because this is the first film of Paul Thomas Anderson that I would give a 10 to, and I'm a big fan of him, but I thought his other films had weaknesses that I could chip at. You know, like, I'm tugging at Superman's cape over here.
If I have one complaint, it will be, I'll say two things now that I think of. It will be, Paul teased us with such great footage in the teasers and in the trailers that aren't in the film.
Yeah.
That aren't even on the Blu-ray. They live on, like you were saying. They're part of the...
Oh yeah, that's another thing.
Of the universe of the film as one big art piece. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. The teasers, like you were saying. I would love to see some of those scenes make the movie, but I understand why they're cut. That's one complaint that he teased us with that. And my other is, you know, Laura Dern is in the movie. She's notable. And, of course, Amy Adams. I would like to have had more scenes with Amy. I would have liked to have another female character just in general. I want to see Paul Thomas Anderson do a female-centric movie one day. Actress-centric movie. I'd like to see what he would do with that.
Yeah, and as much as this is PTA's best at everything, I still think his strongest character is in Boogie Nights, female-wise.
Amber Waves?
Yeah, so.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
So. And it's been over 15 years since that movie, so I'd like to see him challenge himself in that way, in terms of dive into a female character. I mean, Aronofsky has done it.
Yeah.
You know, where he dove into... Natalie Portman's psyche, Nina, I believe, in Black Swan. It's something I'd like to see most directors do. Quentin Tarantino, I think personally, he writes women really well. You know, with the exception of Django Unchained, that's the first time he's written a woman as a damsel in distress.
Yeah.
That's because that's the legend calls for that. But Quentin has always wrote women really well. Maybe with, you know, of course, there's no women in Reservoir Dogs. But True Romance, Patricia Arquette's character, Alabama's written really strong. I like seeing that in movies. I think Amy is as militant as she should be and as strong as she should be and maintains a wonderful, strong presence in that film. I definitely would have loved more. I mean, I think we got an adequate amount, but I would have loved a lot more to explore where she's coming from, even though it's not necessarily about her. She's one of the women behind the curtain of
but,
the movie.
But you can tell that she is a full character because she does have the militant scene, and she does have the scene where she's our ex-wife, so she does have a little bit of jealousy in her too.
Sure.
And you get very... Like, every scene she's in, there's a lot to take in from her character. She's mm-hmm. probably, like, in four scenes, like, as the centerpiece.
Mm-hmm.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of objective criticism. I have problems with, like, people.
Yeah.
And their feelings about the film than I do about the film itself.
You know what? That baby that she was carrying was a bad actress.
You know what? Fuck her.
Yeah, fuck that baby.
That little baby, right?
Yeah.
The one on the little trike?
Yeah. She didn't
trying to make it all about her?
Yeah.
I did not appreciate that, actually. I thought, because when I saw it in 70mm, I thought they were going to digitally take her out for the Blu-ray.
Yeah.
I thought they were going to George Lucas her.
Yeah. I don't even know what she was doing in the film. She's obviously out of her league.
I thought there were some scenes where the little kid was boring. And there were some scenes where I thought she was overacting.
That scene where she's running away from Phyllis and Hoffman, what the fuck she doing?
I don't know. Just making it about her. I didn't appreciate that.
Yeah.
I've already wrote my governor to try to take that out of the Texas Blu-ray.
Yeah.
So we'll see if that can happen. That's a big time criticism.
Yeah.
If I can be honest.
Yeah, that baby. Fuck her.
She was awful. Well, where can we find you?
You can find me on Twitter at JuanTX, JuanM, and filmwork.com. And filminaustin.com and on Facebook.
You can find me at Knives Monroe. That's on Twitter, at Knives Monroe. And don't forget to like the Filmwork page on Facebook. Link will be down below. You know what? This is a pleasure talking to you, man. I could talk about the master all day, every day. But I think we hit all the notes that we wanted to hit.
Yeah. I mean, maybe 5 years from now we do a retrospect or something. Because we probably have new stuff to talk about.
Oh, yeah. And also, you know, 2 years from now we'll be able to talk about his next film, Inherent Vice.
Yeah.
So that should be interesting.
There you go. So good things about the master is everything. Bad thing is that fucking baby.
Fuck the baby. I can't stress that anymore. Check it out on Redbox. Download it. Buy it. Go to a pulga, go to a flea market, do whatever you have to do to watch this movie. It's worth it. People will be talking about this movie for decades to come. I think it's, you know, the 21st century Taxi Driver in a lot of weird ways. That's pretty much all I have to say about that. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about this on the podcast. This is episode one, and I look forward to talking on episode two.
Yeah, cool. Same here.
Thanks, guys.
Till next time.